Welcome to the latest edition of the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler, and today is Monday, October 26th. This episode of Oncology Peer Review on the Go examines an article published in the October issue of the journal Oncology titled Considerations for the Management of Oncology Patients During the COVID-19 Pandemic. The piece focuses on the management of the coronavirus pandemic and best practices for patients with cancer. For detailed information regarding this article, I spoke with two authors of the study, Drs. Jeffrey Schneider and Mark Braunstein from the NYU Winthrop Hospital. Dr. Braunstein, Dr. Schneider, thank you so much for joining me and taking the time to be here to talk about your piece. I was hoping we could start with just a general summary of the piece and some of the key points you hope to make when you were writing it.
Sure. So I can start us off. So thank you for your question. So this manuscript came about during the peak of the pandemic in our area in Nassau County, New York, where essentially over 95% of the hospital was consumed with COVID-19 cases. And so we had to obviously adapt our practice in oncology to manage patients during that complicated time at the peak of the pandemic. And so in collaboration with two of our more senior fellows who were the first authors of this manuscript, we wrote this paper entitled Considerations for the Management of Oncology Patients During the COVID-19 Pandemic in order to highlight some key areas, including the pathophysiology of SARS-CoV-2 infection, treatment approaches to treat patients with COVID-19, including repurposing some chemotherapy agents to treat patients with COVID-19, and also some practical logistical considerations for adjusting treatment protocols to manage oncology patients during the pandemic.
I can add a couple of points related to sort of motivation for making this contribution. And I would say that the most straightforward reason that we wanted to put this out was that the unique aspect of COVID pandemic was that it came in a flurry and then was and migrated to other populations. And so we had an early experience that we thought was useful to share, a very unique, scenario where we were flooded with COVID patients. Our hospital was literally replaced with COVID patients. We have a 591 bed facility, and we were above capacity with exclusive COVID patients and a smattering of people coming in with, things that couldn't be resisted, like traumatic injuries or, women literally coming in, giving birth, and then heading right back home. So it was unique times, and there were a few things that sort of fell out that we felt motivated to share with the larger medical community. One was, how do we protect our patients, our cancer patients, from COVID illness? There was a lot of concern that they might be more vulnerable to COVID, and how do we treat them when they get COVID illness? Two was the idea of protecting our cancer center so that we could keep it as a safe place and continue to offer cancer therapy when our resources were really strapped. We didn't have operating rooms. We didn't have the luxury of even diagnostic procedures. So there was a lot of challenges in terms of what was adequate care for our cancer patients because of these times.
So kind of getting into the specifics of the article, Dr. Braunstein, you mentioned this in your response regarding the pathophysiology of COVID-19. What is the importance of kind of understanding that, and why is the pathophysiology integral in better understanding how the disease behaves?
Sure, thank you. So, you know, certainly understanding the pathophysiology of the novel 2019 coronavirus is critical both for understanding why it presents clinically with pneumonia, with cytokine storm, and why certain patients become sicker than others. And so, you know, we learned some lessons from SARS-CoV-1 that could be applied. And in the manuscript, we discuss some of the analogies to SARS-CoV-2 infection. I think that at the time of the peak of the pandemic, when we were first drafting the manuscript, we really didn't know much about why patients were mounting such a robust immune response and whether that was beneficial or not. So understanding the dynamics of SARS-CoV-2 infection was important to figure out how we could go about treating it. And so, you know, initially there was reluctance to treat patients with a severe infection with steroids. Now we understand that that might actually be beneficial to suppress some of the inflammation that leads to severe pneumonia. In addition, a lot of the risk factors that increase the risk for severe COVID-19 are similar to the risk factors that increase the risk of COVID and the risk of poor of cancer and the risk of poor outcomes in patients receiving chemotherapy. So part of the goal specifically in oncology of understanding the pathophysiology was to see whether there were any factors that we could adjust for our cancer patients that might mitigate their risk of severe infection.
So, you know, 7 to 8 months into a pandemic in the United States, at this point, it's pretty well known that patients with cancer are considered a vulnerable population for COVID-19. But, you know, what has the existing literature that you and your team reviewed, what has that shown you to expand on this idea? And I guess more generally speaking, what stood out to you in your review of the literature?
So if we're talking about, you know, why certain, you know, populations experience severe disease differently, specifically in oncology patients, a lot of the data initially came from China and Italy, where the first brink of the pandemic was started and investigated. And there was actually a paper by Liang and colleagues in Lancet Oncology that showed that 39% of cancer patients, compared to 8% of the general population, were more likely to require intensive care. And additional data showed that patients who recently received chemotherapy or surgery were much more likely to develop COVID-19 infection than the general cancer patient population. So there have been various studies that have looked into why patients with cancer or recent treatment were more likely to develop COVID-19 or develop severe COVID-19. And I think those investigations are still ongoing. And some of the risk factors seem to be similar to the general population, such as metabolic disorders, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, diabetes. And some of it may be specific to particular treatment regimens, such as immunotherapy. I think we're still learning about cancer patients specifically, but you know, myself focusing on hematologic malignancies and my colleague Dr. Schneider, who's focused in thoracic oncology, those two areas actually seem to be areas where patients are particularly susceptible to severe COVID-19. In the literature, especially that I'm familiar with, the patients with hematologic malignancies, for example, acute leukemia, seem to be especially prone to severe COVID-19. And part of that could stem from their baseline disease factors. But I think also, you know, perhaps also in thoracic oncology for patients on immune checkpoint inhibitors, they may be more prone to COVID-19 as well.
So I want to circle back to your suggestion that why was it important to present the pathophysiology and sort of lead with that. and viral pathophysiology is not necessarily something that is, you know, an oncologist's expertise, but I think that it is extremely important to recognize and to present ourselves as evidence-based scientific leaders. And, you know, I think that, you know, there's so much spin now with the political environment that doctors are kind of joining into that in a way that is not the way we would like to represent our contribution, at least not in the fashion that we are disciplined. So there are a lot of suggestions of things. So at the beginning of the pandemic, there were things that seemed to make sense, and we tried them. And then as we got deeper into the pandemic, there were things that had been tried that we then had evidence, and we were able to say, you know, what the results were. So the understanding the viral pathophysiology, for example, was extraordinarily helpful in telling us how we could better define periods of time when individuals that were exposed should be isolated, whether there was concern about, you know, contamination from surfaces, what the meaning of being antibody positive would suggest. I mean, if you, again, the article does a nice job of describing what it means to have a so-called antibody against the spike protein, which is thought to be a neutralizing antibody, the difference between that and an antibody that might just suggest exposure, but might not represent a protective antibody. So there is a science that drives the experience. And then again, in terms of the evidence that has emerged, we were particularly concerned at the outset that perhaps because we understand that the cytokine storm and the exuberant immunologic response to this virus is often the thing that's most responsible for the adverse effects that it causes to patients that get very sick. We were concerned that immunotherapy for cancer might interdigitate with viral pathophysiology to make that exuberant inflammatory response even worse. And in fact, the literature, and particularly in the lung space, there's a large series looking at what's called, or the study was called TerraVault. That trial did not demonstrate any increased adversity to patients that were on immune checkpoint therapies, which is the common immunotherapy given for lung cancer. And in fact, it suggested that patients that had recent chemotherapy were the ones that were most compromised by their cancer therapy. So that's sort of, that's information that we could only have speculated upon at the beginning of the pandemic, but then shortly afterwards, we were able to actually provide, you know, sound information about the consequences of those kinds of treatments on patients with COVID.
So you look at the investigational therapies in your review following that pathophysiology section. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about any that were particularly promising or, you know, potentially significant in treating COVID-19. And I specifically want to talk a little bit about the three areas that you mentioned in that section, those being anti-cytokine strategies, convalescent plasma, and repurposed anti-neoplastic agents.
Yeah. So again, I think it's a great segue. And I think that the, you know, one of the things that should stand out to the audience here is that there are two general approaches to attacking this virus. One is to direct antiviral therapies. So remdesivir is an example of an antiviral agent that is designed to attack the virus directly, and antibody-mediated therapies, so like convalescent plasma, but also you know, the Regeneron antibody cocktail. Those are therapies that are designed to attack virus. And then there's a second set of therapies that are designed to tamper down this robust immunologic response, the so-called cytokine storm. And it's important to recognize that those therapies based on viral pathophysiology are best applied at different times in the course of the viral illness. It doesn't make a lot of sense to be giving patients anti-cytokine therapies when they're very first infected, but it makes a lot of sense to give them antiviral therapies to kill the virus at that point before it can evolve. Now, this virus pretty much disappears by 10 days, you know, post-symptoms. Now, some people say a little longer for people that, become very sick, but most of the data suggests that the virus is largely gone after 10 days. We had a large experience with convalescent plasma. Actually, we were the, and I think we still are, the leading accruer. Our hospital, NYU Winthrop on Long Island, was the largest accruer to the largest randomized trial of convalescent plasma. The results of that have not yet been published, but I'll tell you that we focused on giving the plasma very early in the course of illness. And the very first reports in the literature, the case reports of convalescent plasma, talked about convalescent plasma being given to patients that had been on ventilators and were, you know, 3, 4, 5 weeks into their illness, when, you know, the prediction would be that the virus is not even present, and the likelihood that the convalescent plasma would be beneficial at that point would be exceedingly low. So again, science drives this, and the idea that we need to tailor our treatments to, you know, early on antiviral therapies, and probably the best bang out of antiviral therapies will come by giving those treatments to high-risk individuals before they even need to be hospitalized. Sort of how we treat the flu. So if somebody has an exposure to influenza, you know, there's a recommendation that you know, individuals that are exposed get Tamiflu for, you know, a course of time. So we would get more mileage out of remdesivir and antibody therapies if they were given early on. And the anti-cytokine therapies, and that I would include in that medications like steroids, are going to have more usefulness when, you know, later in the course of illness, when patients are suffering, you know, that inflammatory response. The other thing that we talked about, you mentioned three things. So there's those two categories, and then there's the repurposing of drugs that we had already had in our oncologic arena. So I'm going to kick that over to Dr. Braunstein to let him talk about that. But so the possibility that existing therapies could be repurposed as anti-cytokine or antiviral exists, you know, for some of our therapies that already exist. So, Dr. Braunstein?
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Schneider. Right, so I think one of the elements of the manuscript that we try to bridge in terms of treatment of COVID and oncology is repurposing agents that we use in the oncology space typically. That may have either antiviral or anti-inflammatory effects. You know, obviously dexamethasone is a clear example of that, though the doses that are used to treat or prevent severe COVID-19 are lower than the doses we typically use, for example, for hematologic malignancies. But the randomized data for dexamethasone was positive and seemed to prevent mortality at 28 days compared to patients who received placebo. In terms of specific agents to highlight, for example, the Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor ibrutinib was studied in a case series published in Blood of six patients with Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia who were treated for that with ibrutinib, and all developed COVID-19 infection, and all had basically their COVID-19 infection resolved in all those cases. So that's being explored in a larger trial. Likewise, there was a randomized phase 2 study of patients with COVID-19 receiving the JAK2 inhibitor ruxolitinib for severe COVID-19. And there were 43 patients in that study randomized one-to-one versus ruxolitinib versus standard of care, and it did show efficacy, an efficacy signal in that study. So there are other examples. For example, many of the interleukin-6 inhibitors, as Dr. Schneider mentioned, to decrease the inflammation that occurs later in the illness, are often used, for example, to treat cytokine release syndrome in oncology patients receiving CAR T cells. And those have shown a reduction in severe COVID-19 duration. So many of these studies remain ongoing, but I think, like Dr. Schneider said, it's really critical in terms of how we design these studies now that we have some time to reassess how we're approaching these studies since we're past the peak in our area, and really determine what the right timing of these interventions are. So I think we'll see more data result now that some of these studies are concluding.
And so working through the manuscript a bit, Dr. Bronstein, you and your colleagues then continue to discuss the logistical modifications that have been made during the pandemic regarding cancer care. How have they impacted care over the past 7 to 8 months? And how have these modifications evolved as time passes and more information is gathered regarding COVID-19?
Right. Yeah, thank you. So many of the modifications that were made initially when we were just, lying by the seat of our pants, essentially, those decisions had to be made quickly and with very little data to guide us. The first set of modifications we had to make, like Dr. Schneider alluded to, was protecting our patients and making modifications to the cancer center and our inpatient unit. So there were certain measures taken that were not yet universal across the board for medical centers in terms of screening patients at the door, asking a series of questions in terms of gauging their risk, taking temperatures, asking about exposures. If patients were exposed or had the infection, then there was a certain period of time in which they would have to quarantine. In terms of protecting the staff as well, like Dr. Schneider said, our office never closed. And so we made modifications to the number of staff in the office to allow for social distancing. We made modifications to the amount of visitors who could be present with patients. And then in terms of cancer specific modifications, it was really a case by case basis in terms of the particular subspecialty of oncology. So when we were limited by the consultancy care in terms of imaging, in terms of interventional procedures, even in terms of surgeries that would be considered standard of care, or upfront treatment of certain solid tumors like breast cancer, modifications had to be made. For example, by giving agents such as aromatase inhibitors upfront that would have been used for adjuvant therapy. So, likewise, stem cell transplantation was temporarily halted, partly to protect patients and partly to reserve additional hospital space. So we had to make decisions, not all of which were evidence-based because there was no evidence to guide us. And we obviously continued essential care where necessary. If a patient, for example, presented with a severe illness with bleeding and had to go for emergency surgery. If a patient was in critical need of an allogeneic stem cell transplant, that still continued. But in cases where, for example, a patient was getting supportive medication that could be either changed to an oral medication or could be postponed, such as bone resorptive agents, we made those modifications where possible.
So I was part of a task force that went across the NYU campuses to establish policy for the cancer. So it was really the Perlmutter Cancer Center task force charged with protecting the cancer center, the cancer center patients, the personnel. And I'll tell you that it would have been wonderful to have just a recording of those conversations, because the way in which they transformed from one meeting to the next was eye-opening. I can recall a meeting where I suggested, so very early on, where I suggested that we stop taking vital signs on patients in the office and minimize physical examinations only to a very, you know, targeted exams. And I got a response initially like that was an absurdity, that we, you know, how could we do that? And, you know, that's not good care. And we may not be able to bill, you know, the proper code for, you know, if we didn't do that. You know, this is early on in the pandemic, to later on in the pandemic, where we were seeing a majority of our patients via, you know, telemedicine. So it was really a rapid transition in the way we looked at what we could do to try to protect our patients. And I think we did a rather good job of setting some guidelines. And interestingly, you know, they say great minds think alike. A lot of the kinds of protections that we put into place, and we weren't plagiarizing other people, we really thought of them independently. But a lot of them were the same things that other places had come up with. You know, the series of questions that people got asked at the door, the temperature screening. So, you know, it's like we almost think that we invented it for everybody because it seemed that everybody else was doing it. But it was what sort of made sense. But we got together and we did those kind of things, and it was transformative for a period of time. We also addressed things like, as Dr. Bronstein had just mentioned, well, if we can't operate on a patient with, you know, locally advanced lung cancer, what can we do to buy them some time? Because the ORs were literally, so our operating rooms were converted to intensive care units because patients needed to be on ventilators. We, you know, more than tripled the number of people that we have on ventilators in the hospital, and we had to put those patients, in proper units. So we couldn't operate on patients, even with diseases like lung cancer, where, you know, timely surgery was considered to be important. So we came up with a variety of protocols to, you know, for second best management in the absence of an operating room. And again, everything sort of has a positive in terms of the way in which we were able to manage patients. And it also has some negatives. So the message that came out to our patients, and a lot of our patients have swallowed this message, was that COVID was much more serious and scary than cancer. And that's a message I would like to take back to some degree, because if you look at the patients that were in the intensive care unit, that was a bad end of COVID illness, and we had to take care of those patients. But the likelihood that you were going to die of COVID illness compared to the likelihood that you're going to die of lung cancer if you don't, you know, take care of it, is like day and night. I mean, the likelihood is much greater that you know, the malignancy is going to challenge your life. And so that was a very important message that we are all still struggling with to get back to, you know, not that we want to frighten people with malignancy, but we literally have people that are hiding behind a cancer diagnosis because of a concern that not even that they have COVID illness, but that they might catch it. So that's a, you know, a repetitive theme that has come up over and over again. And we're working on that. It's remains a challenge.
And so really at the end of the day, it's really impossible to fully know what the future holds in regards to the COVID-19 pandemic. But are there any, you know, particular therapeutics, potential developments, or just general information that you found in your research that might give some kind of insight into the future of this disease? Dr. Bronstein, I'll start with you.
So, you know, I think there are two races going on. One of them obviously is prevention and looking for vaccines. And there are several different, I guess those are competing industries that are developing vaccines with different valency and different targets to prevent the SARS-CoV-2 infection. The other element is treatment for patients who develop infection. And, you know, we talked about some of the data we have in hand now that are randomized, for example, for remdesivir, dexamethasone, convalescent plasma. So, you know, I think those two critical elements of therapeutics are critical to getting us kind of back to some sense of normal and to overcoming the pandemic. In addition, I think we still have to advocate for, you know, preventive measures that we can all take, social distancing, you know, appropriate wearing of masks, and all these other protective measures, while those studies of prevention and treatment are still ongoing. So I am encouraged by the progress that's being made at both prevention and treatment. And I think those are two really critical elements of getting us past the pandemic. And I am hopeful that in the coming year, in 2021, that we will see the approvals of both vaccines as well as more effective therapeutic avenues to prevent severe infection.
Well, Dr. Braunstein, Dr. Schneider, thank you so much for taking some of your time and providing us with this insight on your manuscript. It was really fascinating to talk with you. And I know that the listeners will really appreciate this information, not only just to navigate oncology, but also just general people just living their lives during this unpredictable time. So thank you so much for your time and insight. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network.